Welcome to Be Honest Podcast with Dr. Yana and Dr. Sherry, where we hold honest conversations about life, relationships, challenges, and everything in between, with unfiltered discussions with real people, offering their authentic stories, experiences, and perspectives. No topic is off limits and no story is too small. Join us on United Public Radio Network 107.7 FM.
Welcome back to New Orleans, everyone. Happy Friday. Thank you for tuning in to United Public Radio 107.7 with Dr. Yana and Dr. Sherry. If you're enjoying our content, don't forget to hit the like and subscribe button on our YouTube channel, Be Honest Talks. Again, just a reminder, this is just personalized advice. Take us with a grain of salt. A grain of salt.
Yeah, sugar. Sugar, grain of salt, grain of sugar.
Any grain you want.
Any grain you want.
Trust your gut and your intuition. Today, we're going to go inside the mind and unravel the complexities of human behavior that are beyond normal. Take it away, Dr. Yana.
Oh, yes. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I would prefer to be taken with grains of sugar, in fact. You know, that's more pleasant, although it is not so good for health. So, but we're not going to go into that, but the sweeter the better. Although, did you know that for many centuries before our well-known Western approach to everything, people actually honored salt. And they would, I know that in the Russian culture, ancient Russian culture, they would offer to the guests bread and salt. And salt is an essential element of our well-being. So, yeah, absolutely. You can take us with grains of salt, not so much sugar, perhaps, but it is your preference.
Everything in moderation. And we absolutely rely on both of them to exist. We need sodium and we also need sugar, glucose. So we're there.
We are getting, interestingly enough, into food categories. Let's talk about our mind and soul. In fact, I believe that we are going to talk about the mind, as the mainstream psychology is in fact treating the mind and not so much of the soul. However, with abnormal psychology, we can touch upon the soul and the psyche and those processes that are in fact underlying all of those processes. So, ladies and gentlemen, have you ever wondered why some people experience intense anxiety or depression while others seem to navigate life with ease? I would like to do that. Well, today we will unlock the mysteries of the human mind and explore the diverse spectrum of mental health conditions that shape our perceptions, behaviors, and experience. So, what is abnormal psychology, Dr. Sherry?
It's a branch of psychology that deals with the study of behaviors, thoughts, and emotions that are beyond the normal social, I would say, societal norm.
Yeah, it's a branch of psychology that deals with psychopathology and abnormal behavior, you know, the patterns of emotion, thought, behavior that can be signs of mental health condition. It encompasses the range of disorders, from depression to obsessive compulsive disorders to personality disorders. However, why do we call it abnormal? I think that the term abnormal has been, in fact, the subject of considerable debate. What exactly is normal in our society or in other societies? And who gets to decide? I believe that the social norms often used to determine what is normal versus abnormal. They can shift over time. So setting on a standard definition isn't actually so simple and straightforward.
That's right, because Viktor Frankl quotes, having an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is actually normal.
This is all about the way that we adapt to this world. And all about the way that we adapt and how we behave, how we relate to the change that happens in our world. You know, a lot of things that have been called abnormal are in fact normal reactions of the human body. And here in the West, we tend to over-pathologize and over-medicate people for normal processes that go in their souls. But because certain conditions, they get in the way that, a disorder or a problem, right? Psychological disorder. When they get in the way of our everyday living, when they become a problem and they mess with us, with our everyday day-to-day existence.
Yes, that's when it becomes a diagnosable thing.
Diagnosable. You know, this is so interesting that last year when I found out that PMS, premenstrual syndrome, got into the DSM-5 and it became a disorder, psychological disorder, became an abnormal thing that happens to women, I was outraged. Can you imagine that? So guys don't have it. Who gets to decide whether that is abnormality, for Pete's sake?
Well, some people have really deep symptoms of it. I mean, some people do have a hard time working with the symptoms that come along with premenstrual, what they would probably call dysmorphic disorder, dysmorphic. Right? You're referring to?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But then again, it has not been a pathology for so many years and centuries. And then all of a sudden, like last year, I think it was last year, year before then, it all of a sudden became a problem. You know, so I believe that in our modern world, we do over pathologize everything. And now we're going to be thinking that, oh, once a month, I have a disorder, dysmorphic disorder. I have everything. Yeah. If we look at that, we can diagnose ourselves with anything.
Absolutely. I think that's what we're here to talk about, it because some people carry their diagnosis in their everyday life and live behind them and not do anything to try to improve their lives or try to live beyond their diagnosis.
And it is so easy to do. I have to agree with you. So many people that come to me for therapy, they a lot of the times accepted their diagnosis, and I don't give out diagnosis. I can help people understand what is happening with them, but they come with already the set diagnosis and they say, well, this is who I am. And then I have to change their approach to themselves. This is not who you are. This is what you have. This is the symptoms that you have. Yes, you can suffer and they present the problem in your life. However, this is not who you are. And it's so difficult, in fact, to even talk through to people and change their understanding of themselves, because they learned how to rely on their diagnosis, like you said, hide behind it. And they take the entire responsibility for their actions of themselves and blame it on their diagnosis. Like, okay, so this is a bipolar disorder. I'm bipolar. This is, for example, right? And then they operate with this terminology and say, stating that, well, this is who I am. What can I do? Right? I have to take medicine. Otherwise, nothing is going to happen. Nothing is going to change. When in fact, a lot that you can do, a lot is it depending on you.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? Is menopause in there, up there? Is menopause up there with the premenstrual dysmorphic disorder?
I don't know. Let's look at that. Menopause.
It's coming. Huh?
It's coming. Everything that is wrong with us women, you know, that it is going to be there. You know, I wouldn't even rely on DSM so seriously as the things I've been developing lately, with shifts in psychology, in identities, in sexual predispositions, gender predispositions. There.
We got you.
Yeah, there. I need to drink some more wine. It's infected.
Cheers.
It's juice.
Oh, yeah, right. Juice. Okay, okay.
Early in the morning.
What are you whining about now? Well, you know, I think it just speaks to the topic of there really is no known cause of why we have mental disorders. It's always, it could be biological, it could be genetic, it could be environmental. There's so many reasons why we could develop a mental disorder, trauma, stress, what we've experienced. There's no direct relation to an exact cause of mental disorders, from what I recall.
Absolutely. They can arise from so many different factors, including, biological, psychological, environmental influences, that's for sure. As Dr. Elliott says, that's for sure, for sure.
That's a big one.
That's a big one. Yeah, biological factors such as genetics, brain chemistry, and neurobiology, they play a significant role in predisposing people to certain disorders, and psychological factors such as early childhood experiences, trauma they experienced, and cognitive patterns can also contribute to the development of psychological disorders. And very important role play environmental factors. Mm-hmm. We all know about stress, socioeconomic status, and cultural influences. Yeah, they can all impact our mental health. And understanding all of these factors is so essential to understanding what psychological disorders are in fact are. So when we think about the manifestations of different disorders. So psychological disorders, they can manifest in absolutely different ways. They're ranging from mild disturbances to severe impairments in functioning, day-to-day functioning. And symptoms can be can include disturbances in mood. We all know about sadness, euphoria, for example, if it is bipolar disorder, and not only depression, cognition, then delusions, hallucinations, and perception, which is distorted perception of reality, dissociation, right, behavior, impulsivity, withdrawal, interpersonal relationships, such as difficulties in social interactions. So the severity and duration of the symptoms, they vary depending on specific disorder and individual characteristics. And I know that, of course, speaking of so many different disorders, we have different treatment approaches. So what are the treatment approaches to some disorders?
Well, there's a combination of, there's interpersonal therapy, there's cognitive behavioral therapies, there's hypnosis. There's a mindfulness. You can do wellness treatments such as like a gym or yoga.
Yeah.
Psychotherapy.
Psychotherapy. Yes.
EDR, which is the eye movement rapid. There's a DBT, dialectical.
Behavior therapy. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's many.
And many. Yeah.
Medication.
Including exactly psychiatric medications, antidepressants, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers. They can alleviate symptoms by targeting neurotransmitter imbalances in the brain. In some cases, alternative treatments such as mindfulness, like you mentioned, yoga, exercise, and then some other complementary therapies can be also beneficial. And I know myself on my own personal experience. It was actually funny. It would be funny if it wasn't so sad, right? I remember that I started having some symptoms, and I'm going to talk about them. I just want to emphasize the difficulty sometimes in defining those disorders, because sometimes it's just absolutely impossible to pinpoint what disorder the person has, because they can overlap and they are concomitant different disorders that come along with them. And you have to have a trained psychologist or psychiatrist, in fact, to help you identify what's happening with you. So I remember that I had, I knew that something was wrong with me. I could not get up from bed for 2 weeks, and it was so bad. It was getting worse and worse and worse, and I had severe stress at the time. I believe it or not, defended my dissertation And then, of course, like after that, my entire body collapsed. I believe that was one of the environmental factors that helped me with that, developing this incredible incapacitated condition. So, and I felt so bad, like unable even to lift up my arms or anything, get up. That was really bad. And then I decided to go to the doctor. So I crawled to the doctor and like, okay, here is my symptoms. Like, I need to know what's going on with me. That took me on a whole year of going from doctor to doctor, seeing all sorts of different specialists. And finally, everyone like footballed me away, stating that this is not my problem, this is not my problem, this is not my problem. So I finally made this huge circle, and I came back to my primary care physician. And she said, you know what? Your body is in fact depressed. I said, how can my body be depressed if my mind is not? In any case, and then I decided to go to a psychiatrist. I said, there must be something wrong with me, because when I was studying abnormal psychology at the university, you know, we all diagnose ourselves. Whatever happens there, whatever we see in medical field, you know, people.
Oh, yeah, we can just use Google, you know.
We use Google, but at the same time, when you study something at school, you immediately assume that, oh, you have all of those symptoms. You know, it's all you. You have it. And medical students are so notorious about it. So I recalled a few disorders from there. And so that I must have some of them, you know. So I went to psychiatrist, and psychiatrist immediately told me that I had a bipolar disorder. And like, you know, it just doesn't sound good to me.
One or two. Bipolar one or two.
She thought it was two.
And the depression. Okay.
Well, the thing is that with the bipolar disorder, what happens is that they're bipolar one, like you said, and bipolar two. And bipolar two is just less severe than the bipolar one, with the less severe depression, right? And less severe manic episodes. While in bipolar one, there will be a full-blown manic episodes and major depressive episodes as well. So this is what she said. And she gave me mood stabilizing medications, and I had nothing wrong with my moods. It's just I was not able to stay awake at the time. So she thought I had the depression and all of that. In any case, long
bipolar,
story.
Bipolar 1 is just manic, usually. Bipolar 2 has both components. But long story short, take us there.
Well, manic, bipolar 1 also has the major depressive episodes, and people suffer tremendously from that. And I'll tell you another episode, the example a little later. So what happened is that after several years of trying different medications that did not work for me, a friend of mine was taking medication for ADHD, and he said, why don't you try it? And I suffered. I could not wake up. I was always feeling so not really down, but I was sleepy all the time, the brain fog. So imagine going a few years of this diagnosis bipolar, and it's like stays in your mind. It's engraved in your mind. This is your diagnosis, right? And then, so I started taking, I tried that medicine that my friend had for ADHD to wake me up. And that medicine was so helpful for me. And I came to the doctor and I said, listen, this is the only medicine that works for me, and I want to be taking this medicine. So she was so upset and stating that, oh, she's a psychiatrist, she knows better and all for me. And I said, this is my body, and this is what it works for me, and this is what I want to be taking. So I started taking that medicine. And to my extreme pleasure and happiness, that psychiatrist, what is it? not resided.
Resigned?
Not resigned.
Prescribed?
Prescribed what? Prescribed. Yes, she prescribed. Yes, she Sherry, just tell me what people do when they get older.
Regress?
Yes, they do regret.
Forget.
We're going to use all the psychological terminology. So she got a pension. What is it? Like, she got old and she
retirement.
Left. Oh, retirement. Oh, my God. See, that word went to just my subconscious and I could not recall that. But can you imagine that? Yeah, so retirement. I guess I'm a little too far from the retirement, so I'm not thinking about that yet.
I give you props. You speak more than one language. So, hey, you know what? It got tied up in there. It's all good.
Retirement. So another doctor came and he told me in her place, he came to the university here, to the hospital, and for about 2 months. And that was such a saving moment for me. He said, Yana, you don't have a bipolar disorder. You were misdiagnosed, and all you have is a very rare sleep disorder. And when I looked up the symptoms, I, in fact, understood that that has been a sleep disorder. And that medicine that I took by chance that my friend was taking, which I don't advise anyone to do, but for me, with my knowledge in psychology, I decided to do that to be safe. And that worked for me. And he said, and I said, then what would be the treatment? He said, the only treatment is going to be the one that you have already been taking, this medicine that I started taking. And I asked my doctor to prescribe it to me to stay awake, in fact. So I would like to stress the fact that while doctors know a lot and they have been trained in psychology, in psychiatry, it is also important to know your own body and to listen to it. And when something just doesn't work, consult, get a second opinion. I should have gotten second opinion before, but that was such a rare sleep disorder. In fact, neurological, and when I asked my neurologist friends, they said that we would not immediately go to that disorder because it is so rare. So know yourself, do your own research.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what is the name of the disorder that you have? What is the sleep disorder? Do you know the name of it?
Wait, Dr. Sherry, we're going to diagnosis here. Like,
okay, we don't have to.
Yeah, I can talk about it. I can talk about it openly because it is called a sleeping beauty syndrome. It's not a disorder. In fact, it's a syndrome because it's complexity of a few different symptoms that did not made into kind of like official disorder diagnosis. That is... In fact,
it's more like neurological than psychopathological, kind of like a narcolepsy, probably in the same spectrum of like
in the same spectrum. In the same spectrum, however, they with a narcolepsy, people fall asleep right away.
And I knew someone like that.
yeah, it is very dangerous, and I know I have a warning signals, and I have to take precautions, of course, but at the same time, I know exactly when it is happening. So yeah, we can be misdiagnosed so many times, and people also come to me with the different diagnoses that do not fit their profile, and doing just the different changes in their lives and going to different mental health professionals, they're able to start making changes in their lives and getting back to sort of like normalizing their lives.
Yeah, I think that's where there's a difference when you talk about psychiatry and psychology, because psychiatrists are medical doctors and they're generally trained on the medical model, and psychologists are trained on a behavioral model. So typically, only in certain states and with certain additional credentials can a psychologist prescribe certain types of medication in their field. But when you go to a psychiatrist, oftentimes they just take this. It's been said that within the first 2 minutes, a psychiatrist will diagnose someone just based on the symptoms that you're presenting. You're like, here's my list of symptoms. And you may fill out a questionnaire, which may give a total in the end, per se. And it'll give that professional or that doctor the number or the symptoms to diagnose you with something. So perhaps that's maybe something that you encountered with a psychiatrist, whereas the psychologist is going to approach more. They may diagnose you as bipolar, but if they can't prescribe you the medication and they're coming from a behaviorist model, then there's going to be a different type of the diagnosis may be the same in the end, but they'll just work on the symptomology, I think, from a different perspective.
Absolutely. If we distinguish psychologist and psychiatrist, we should remember that if psychology, the ology refers to the study of the topic, and then psychiatry is iatry at the end, refers to medical treatment. So yes, you're absolutely right. And but the thing is that the psychologists were not able to find anything. And at least the one doctor even erroneously was giving me different medications, thinking that she's doing a great thing. However, it's absolutely essential to listen to people. But when you're a patient of a psychiatrist, it is not so easy to make those decisions for yourself. And you have to rely on the help of the medical professional.
Yeah, because you can just, they'll range you on your psychotropics, right? They're going to be like, well, it appears that you have maybe bipolar, or maybe you have a lot of anxiety. So I'm going to prescribe you this for maybe these symptoms and this maybe so you can sleep at night. And if things aren't working out the next time I see you, then we can adjust the medication until we adjust to however makes you feel better, if you choose that route.
Yes, if you choose that route, and people go years and years trying to adjust the medication, and it's
even
not
putting their children on it.
Yeah, putting the children on it. And with ADHD, this has been such a controversial topic here. With ADHD, small children have been absolutely medicalized, right?
They, strong medication, too.
Strong, I mean, medication.
It's like, wow.
Yeah, that prevents their growth. And I know, I understand that this is what happens, that they have to be able to be like everybody else and be able to absorb the information and be able to sit in class. But at the same time, they have different kind of outlook on life. And not every child who is hyperactive has ADHD. So we have to be really cautious in the diagnosis here and not over pathologize, but a lot of parents don't know about it, and they immediately go and if the medical professional, even schools, they can suggest that this is what your child has, you need to have them evaluated. But at the same time, you have to be your child's advocate. I know that you, Dr. Sherry, as an existential psychologist, you don't really acknowledge diagnosis. You approach it from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about it?
Yeah, it's like we try to take, instead of focusing solely on what's happened in the past, we try to take about how are you in the present moment and what can we do in the present moment to get to continue to live in a better way. How do we live now in the moment with what we have, instead of focusing on how we got there? Doesn't mean you can't talk about the things that have created trauma in your life. It's just like we can't change those things that have happened to us, but we can change how we react to these things when we're in the present.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And a lot of the times that I know now, especially in California, we have such places where people can go for spiritual emergencies. Which in fact, in psychiatry, there would be considered a diagnosis immediately. People would be put on medications when their psyche is just trying to knock through that huge wall of your mental barriers, right? In order to let you know that something is wrong. You have to deal with it. You have to deal with me, with your soul, right? You have to talk to me. And people do go on this spiritual emergencies, that a lot of unconscious content comes up, and
never heard of that before.
Never heard. Oh,
spiritual,
yeah.
Emergency.
Spiritual emergencies, exactly. And we have places here in California and probably around the world, but they're more prevalent here in Southern California, where you can actually go and under supervision undergo your processes of spiritual emergencies.
What is a spiritual emergency?
Well, with a spiritual emergency, that if you're a spiritual person, you will be able to actually understand that this is what's happening and not, in fact, go to a psychiatrist to get yourself admitted. But it can actually also imitate the symptoms of some psychiatric problems, that we're going to talk about mood disorders and personality disorders. And we can see that those symptoms are in fact they resemble all of those disorders, some of those disorders, but people don't really believe in that. And they treat it as their soul wanting to talk to them. And a lot of the times this could be a great approach. So for example, in 10 days after people decided to go on those retreat centers, they are in fact get better. They get better. They let out all of this unconscious content that they have. They talk to people there. There can be some medical doctors as well, some psychologists, or just people that they can talk through the experiences that are occurring in their souls. I know that, for example, like if we, there are modern examples, of course, as well, but if we look at the Jungian psychology, and Jungian psychology is not a part of the mainstream psychology in the West. However, he looked at schizophrenia and he was a Swiss psychiatrist, and he was able to give us the glimpse into what in fact is happening in the mind of the schizophrenic. So he told a story that happened in his practice once, that he had a patient in his psychiatry practice, and that patient was saying all sorts of, as he thought, crazy things, as people with schizophrenia would talk about, very not the normalized talks, something that would be fantastic, of the fantastical nature, not fantastic, of the fantastical, phantasmagoric nation, nature. So that patient was talking about some story about the sun and how it travels in the sky and different mythological creatures that would accompany it. And of course, for the psychiatrist, it was just the talking of the schizophrenic mind. Nevertheless, he recorded that. So several years later, and of course, end of 19th century, beginning of 20th century, we did not have internet. People did not have wide access to libraries, to the information as we have right now. So Carl Jung, he came across an old manuscript that was never published before. And he read the story that his patient, schizophrenic patient, was talking about a few years back. And that was an exact story. And Carl Jung was able to understand and devise the notion of collective unconscious, because that patient did not have any access to that story before. He did not see it in any library because that manuscript was never published. So if we look at that information, that patient was able to access in his schizophrenic state, correct? He was able to access some information on that mythological story, right? And
a delusion?
We can consider that a delusion. However, how did he get access to that particular manuscript, that story in that manuscript that was never published? So essentially, Carl Jung came to the understanding of the collective unconscious and of the idea that all of the information of the world is written somewhere in one particular spot, and we can all tap into that. So if we look at the schizophrenic behavior now and think that it is all just the blabbering of the sick mind, we will lose a lot. However, there are different approaches to that. Like, for example, from the existential perspective, you are going to approach the schizophrenic battered like from...
I actually would not treat a schizophrenic person. I would I would refer someone who is suffering from delusions, hallucinations, disorganized thinkings, or distorted perception. If I had any inkling that someone was suffering from a schizophrenia or that type of behavior, I would probably refer them to someone who could provide them with a higher level of care, because schizophrenia is a severe mental disorder. And it, oftentimes these people cannot live on their own without the help of something or someone.
Absolutely.
And oftentimes it's comorbid. I mean, you have the pre-morbid things that can happen, like in the personalities, you have the paranoid, the schizoid, and the schizotypical. Those are like clusters of a personality disorder someone may display that seemingly represent schizophrenia. But when it's generally, that's like an onset of schizophrenia. But I think if I were to deal with someone with schizophrenia, I would definitely refer them to someone. First of all, they probably would not seek me help, because people who are suffering from schizophrenia generally would not trust me to help them.
Yes, well, not really particularly seeking you for being able to help them. But if you heard of some case, you would be able to even tractate it differently, to analyze it differently, and possibly, like, I'm a mythologist, I would be able to, and I would be willing to investigate that and see whether what the person is saying is in fact existing in the ancient literature, the stories of the past, but whether that shows something about them, whether that helps them in the regular day-to-day life, is a totally different question. But if that Jungian patient was saying, was in fact just being given the medication without him making that observation, we would just medicate everybody without even the possibility of looking at their psychics, looking at the psychological manifestation, psychological understanding of their condition. So,
yeah,
absolutely.
Oftentimes it takes over their life. So they are often admitted somewhere and put into the system, I would say. I worked with with people with severe mental disorders in an ACT program, which is assertive community treatment. And it's a deep one, I would say. But it is a fascinating, because we wonder, and that's the beauty of the human mind, right? To wonder. Wonder what if. Because sometimes it seems like they're over-medicated. Like sometimes they would be given an antipsychotic injection, and it's almost like they were, forgive me for saying this, for lack of a better way to say it, like zombies. Just kind of
yes, that's exactly what it is. They look like zombies.
Until they come out of it, you know.
Until they come out of it. And a lot of the times they have to be kept medicated in order for them not to even bring to surface all of those irrational thoughts and behaviors. And that is not an easy thing. I remember that when I was working in the 72-hour psychiatric ward, and oh my God, that was I can't say interesting. Yes, it was interesting. It was mind-blowing experience, because for me at the time,
stuff there, huh? Like, that's like a 5150.
Yeah, but I remember that you mentioned that we should be discussing also the paranormal overlap with some psychological psychiatric disorders, right? And I was thinking about that. And in fact, I started thinking about my own experience in that psychiatric ward. When I was working there, a lot of people, and of course they were like zombies, right? Because they were 72 hours. They had to be diagnosed as well and being given the medication for them not to be violent, because a lot of them were violent. And I decided to go, in fact, and sit in the area where they were getting together from their rooms. And that was a TV area, kind of a get together area. And I sat there, and it was so uncomfortable for me to do that, because people, the patients that were there, they were speaking of, that's what I thought at the time, of course, the crazy stuff, right? But they all looked to me as not even humans. There was nothing, like you said, that the zombies are one thing when
It sounds like a depersonalization type of a disassociative diagnosis there, or disorder.
Absolutely. With all of the dissociative disorders, however, when you give them medication, of course, they have to calm down, right? But nevertheless, the disorder is still there. And those people, they looked at me with the eyes, not just the simple eyes of the person that has normal mental processes, right? They all had the look in their eyes, the look of the predator, the animal. And to me, it was very interesting. I could not understand why some of them did not have at least, understand that they were not normal in the eyes of psychiatry or the society. That's why they were brought up there by the police, by the law enforcement, by their relatives as well. But they did not have any look in their eyes that would resemble a human look. That's very interesting
because I didn't experience that in my experience with people with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. I didn't see a demonized, empty look, and I just would, I guess, to describe it as just kind of like in a different realm, but never.
Yeah, I didn't different realms.
Negative feeling from it.
But I did not say demonized. And of course, that's a realm of totally different sciences. But here, that was my observation, that they did not have kind of connectedness in their eyes to themselves or even people around them. So this is what I'm trying to say. And okay. Of course, like being medicated, they had to dissociate, I believe, with themselves, like with what was happening with them, and they were tranquilized, and was being tranquilized, people look completely different, and they're not themselves. I know myself, and you know it. Like if we have some sort of a problem, we take some painkillers with narcotics, right? And they're like, then you don't have your own brain in your head, right? It's like something else. Like you are completely gone out of yourself. So we all, I believe, experience that at some point. But that was a very interesting experience there.
But what we know
is that there are cultural and contextual factors that play a very significant role in shaping the perceptions of mental health. And that would be across different societies and communities. And I met people there in that psychiatric ward from all sort of ethnic backgrounds, and in their communities, for example, there were Ukrainians and there were Middle Easterns, and for them the approach to this mental conditions was different than here in the West.
Yeah, some places will actually shun the family members. They would be shunned from their group or their tribe or their they would be looked at as maybe a different type outcast. Of entity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's a different type of entity as well. Their cultural beliefs and values, they shape the understanding of mental health and illnesses and the way how they are conceptualized within their society. From culture to culture, there are different approaches. I, for example, know that in Soviet Union, what the science of psychology and therapists, the availability of therapists was not as developed. And it's not because people did not have any mental issues, but because the approach in collective societies is different. We call it like if we have any problems, we would just call it like getting together in a kitchen, right? And beating the problems to death. Like you talk about it, you find solutions. And that
most people sweep it under the rug here in the West. Used to.
Well, still do, and I do, and we all do, you know. However, when I was going to school, together with you, by the way, at the same time, I learned that the United States was the leading country in the number of psychologists. And if not, like, every second person was in therapy. And then at the same time, my professor at the time, I told her, remember that, listen, I said, I can't go like this. It's been so much stress for me. I need to have a break. I cannot finish this class. I just have to take care of myself. And she told me, well, you think, Jana, that you are in this psychological field, and you think that it is so easy to do it. And what do you think? I've been in therapy for the past 20 years. And I thought, oh my God, that professor had a clinical practice of her own, and her herself was in therapy for the past 20 years at the time, and she was already like 55 at the time. And I thought, what am I getting myself into? We're getting into places to solve our own, right? Into those different fields to solve our own problems and to help other people as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, therapy is a good outlet for people. I mean, therapy doesn't always mean that you go to get medicated, and it's always good to have somebody to speak to objectively. You know, you can, that's why there's like coaches as well. There's, you know, there's psychologists. They try to tend to treat you, but then you can say, hey, I'd like, they might say, why don't we see each other once a month instead of every week? Or how about you come every 6 weeks or something, and we can talk about your life and how things are going. So I think therapy is a good outlook for someone who's seeking an objective response.
Absolutely. However, in Western cultures, especially here in the United States, we often emphasize a biomedical model that focuses on diagnosing and treating mental disorders as such distinct entities. So this cultural beliefs that influence attitudes toward even seeking professional help. Like I said, here in the United States, it is so funny that the number of psychologists, they're much, much bigger. It was number one leading country.
Well, I think it's more taboo in a lot of other places. You just don't seek out or help. It's shunned upon for you to actually go outside and seek help. Existentialist Rollo May said in one of his interviews that there comes a time at the end of an era that there's usually a psychologist for every person. That's when you know things are about to change, erupt, however we want to title that.
Yeah, true. I was in New York once years back, and I was in Manhattan, and everyone was talking about their psychologists and the therapists that they were in. And I was so surprised. And every single person that I met, and they were normal people in my understanding, that, but they were so proud of just having a therapist and going through therapy, working on themselves, that to me, it was something extraordinary at the time. And like, and I, what is this? Like, they said that every single person in Manhattan is in therapy. That was funny to me.
Well, I mean, if people tried to eat right and did more exercise, and, you know, I can't tell people to practice on a spiritual modality, maybe they would benefit just without seeking therapy. I mean, there's many outlets out there. But some people think just by talking to someone and having a therapist, it's some kind of, it cushions the reality a bit.
Oh, yes. And shows other people that they're working on themselves. And I'm so glad that nowadays we destigmatize mental health as much as we can and making it normal and acceptable for people to actually seek mental health professionals, seek help. Because, with stigma and discrimination, it's been very difficult, even in our society, with the misconceptions, and stereotypes, and fear that surrounds mental health. Because I was actually, in fact, scared seeing all these people talking completely nonsensical things. But nevertheless, it was a time for me to learn about it. And that was a huge eye-opening experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also the cultural norms and expressions of distress that they play significant role. So, cultural norms that dictate how people express and interpret distressing emotions and behaviors, right? Like I mentioned, in collectivist societies, people would just get together, they will talk. And if you mention that, oh, you need to have a psychologist, like that they will even look at you like you're out of your mind, you fell from the moon, you know?
Well, a lot of people in today's society as well are misinformed. They don't understand the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist. They don't understand one is prescribes medicine and the other one is generally there to help guide you to work on your processes and your diagnosis. You know, most of the diagnoses are for insurance purposes.
Oh, yes. Because,
you know, you don't have to diagnose someone in your office. And but I think you give them some type of information as a clinical licensed individual, because you have to have it for insurance purposes. You have to have some reason to fit the code as to why you're prescribing or a therapy per se for someone.
Absolutely. Well, it is not an easy topic. However, you are live with us on United Public Radio Network 107.7 FM. We are streaming live with our fantastic podcast and the radio show The Honest Talks from New Orleans, Louisiana. And Dr. Sherry is absolutely fortunate even to live there. How's the weather there, Dr. Sherry?
Well, it was cold the last couple of days, and now it's in the 70s, I think high 70s. So sometimes it'll dip to cold, and then after you need a jacket to go to school for the little ones, and in the afternoon you're in shorts again.
Wow, in shorts again. That is so interesting. I was thinking about our children. They were thinking of going to Las Vegas in the summertime. I'm like, I will never go to Las Vegas in the summertime again because it was so hot and my skin was coming off my flesh, but revealing my bare bones. It was just a torture. It was really hot.
It's scorching hot on that side.
Scorching.
Like Arizona.
Desert. Yes. So I'm absolutely fine living in San Diego.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful place. I often miss it. I lived there so long and I do miss it, but I actually really love it here as well.
I know. I need to come visit there as well. So should be very interesting. I've been to New Orleans one time and it spooked me. But all of the stuff that is happening
really
there.
Spooked you well. Spooked needed therapy.
Yeah, I needed therapy after that PTSD. But it's a beautiful place with so much history.
Yeah, especially with your paranormal background, it seems like you would almost be drawn to this place because it is such a paranormal, has an emphasis in that category.
Oh, yeah.
Or sect, study.
Yeah. I wonder why we translate from New Orleans now.
Right? Yes. Nothing happens by accident.
No, nothing happens by accident. And indeed, that place was very spooky to me. In fact, when I was there, I think it was a year and a half after that awful flood. What year was it?
2005.
Yeah, it was about a year and a half. And of course, I saw it all on the TV, how things were developing at the time. But when I stepped my foot on the streets, I was able to see the bodies floating on the streets. And that was awful. I thought I would never go there again. But it's actually, sometimes it's good to be able to see into the past, present, and the future. But at the same time,
I'll pass on that.
Oh, yeah. So sometimes I just don't want to know.
Diagnosing myself with hallucinations and delusions.
Yeah, but in fact, those visions were something that in fact happened there, and that had a profound effect on me.
But
so
they do fascinate me, and I'm very intrigued, and I do enjoy learning more about it and understanding it. I just haven't had the capacity to see, but I have had experienced premonitions in this lifetime.
Premonitions, intuition, this is what it's all about. This is the intuition that is developed in some people and underdeveloped in others, which is okay.
I think we should talk about parapsychology one of these weeks.
One of these weeks, exactly, the connection of psychology to parapsychology. Yeah, absolutely, we should do that. And in fact, Dr. Elliot and I, the name of our radio show is science and the paranormal. And paranormal is small, para is small letters and normal with cap letters.
Yeah, on Tuesdays.
Yeah, on Tuesdays. On Tuesdays, please, every Tuesday at 7 o'clock Pacific time. And I believe it is 3 o'clock. Not 3 o'clock. What am I talking about?
9 o'clock Central time.
9 o'clock
Eastern
Central time. That's right. Exactly. Thank you, Dr. Sherry. You're more knowledgeable.
And also knowledgeable. On United Public Radio.
Also on United Public Radio Network. Exactly. So check that out. Because as we were talking today, there are some conditions are in fact normal, but just over-pathologize them. Or we don't know enough to draw conclusions. And that is why we deem it as abnormal. So, Dr. Sherry, shall we go into mood disorders?
Mood, yes. Mood, personality. I'm more about the OCD things. I mean, but let's go into the mood. Because I think we've already touched on bipolar and depressive disorder, right? I mean,
yes, we did. So
I think we've been moody already. We can move on.
And this is just an observation of the mood disorders and personality disorders. So this is not designed to help anyone to diagnose themselves or people around them. So please don't do that. When in fact, you know, when you know so much about abnormal psychology, you have a tendency to diagnose people around. And I remember how my professor at the time of the abnormal psychology course, she said, "Now I need to warn you, when you're outside, out and about, do not diagnose your friends, family members, and just people that you meet." So yes, mood disorder.
Because there's such a deep criteria that comes along with diagnosing people. And I think that's a hindrance of today's societal views of like just diagnosing people with these narcissistic and antisocial personality disorder. And, you know, people who are diagnosing other people without clinical experience often are diagnosing a part of themselves as well. If you spot it, you got it. There you go, you know.
Well, spot it, you got it, but then you can be wrong because if you're in the medical field and you spot it, you can have all of the disorders that are in the medical book of disorders because you always find symptoms in yourself, in the people that you know. So got to be careful about that.
I think of all the personality disorders that they do have, the only one that really people may consider themselves as bipolar, but less and less likely people are going to say, "I have borderline. Oh my goodness, I'm antisocial. I'm narcissistic. You know, like I have histrionic. I'm avoidant." You're not going to have a lot of people who are going to like be raising their hands to identify with a personality disorder.
Nevertheless, some do, like for example, with the borderline, and the borderlines approach their interpersonal relationships differently. And sometimes they do disclose it if they were diagnosed with that to potential romantic partners. Oh, I have a borderline.
I think people take portions of borderline personality disorder and diagnose themselves. A high percentage of people who are diagnosed, if they even go to therapy with borderline personality disorder, don't often believe they have it because they often times are that, not to say grandiose, right? But they oftentimes don't even believe they suffer from that. But you're right. There are some cases where people will speak about it.
Oh, yes. Yes. It says that the prevalence of borderline personality disorder affects about 1.4% of adults in the United States. I think it's much more than that.
But borderline, again, that's only what's diagnosed in.
That was diagnosed, absolutely. And a lot of the times it's difficult to diagnose because people with borderline tendencies, they're not necessarily going to go and seek help and say that, "Oh, listen, something is wrong with me. I have problems with anger," right? That I have.
They don't believe they have a problem. They don't believe that they see black and white. Sometimes people get to where they may be harming themselves, like cutting or, you know, and those, there's a high percentage of people with borderline personality disorder. Years ago, what I read was also have a high prevalence of suicide
Suicide
attempts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah, the symptoms of borderline personality disorder, they include the intense fear of abandonment. That is one of the most crucial ones. And then unstable relationships. And of course, because of the anger issues that they have, that they let out the anger on people. And with the quiet borderlines, they direct it against themselves. They have a distorted self-image. Their identity is always shifting. And in fact, borderline personality disorder is sometimes can be mistaken with dissociative identity disorder, because the changes can be so abrupt and so noticeable. It's like a totally different person emerges. Like in the morning, the person can wake up and feel totally different, having a totally different identity. And it is visible, of course, to other people around them and to themselves as well. But I know several people who may have borderline personality disorder, and they do not acknowledge that. And especially people in the spiritual communities, they believe that everything that they do is in fact, for example, directed by some divine force, and they would adopt the different identities, even from months to months, sometimes it's a day to day, and they would adopt personalities, images of other people with whom they are infatuated, for example. And that is really interesting. And when they don't think that they have some sort of a problem, that they have to be grounded, they have to be working on themselves, because once you know it, you are able to tackle it, right? You are able to understand that comes from this constant identity shift, comes from the inability to keep the core one identity for yourself. So people prefer in the spiritual communities, especially to believe that this is the voice of God directing them. And day to day, they may be just hearing different kinds of messages what they should be doing, you know. And that is not easy to live for people like that. But nevertheless, they manage to survive and have the normal lives. So other symptoms, there are impulsivity, self-destructive behaviors, the crazy mood swings, and chronic feelings of emptiness. We spoke about intense anger and difficulty controlling emotions. So that would be borderline personality disorder. Well, since we are in personality disorders, Dr. Sherry, we already touched upon the schizotypal personality disorder. And with the symptoms of eccentric behavior and appearance, magical thinking, unusual perceptual experiences, odd beliefs or superstitions, social anxiety and paranoia, difficulty forming close relationships, and eccentric speech patterns. And with schizotypal personality disorder, there's only 3.9% of the adults in the United States. So perhaps that there is a hope. And you spoke about histrionic personality disorder. It's a very interesting one. Can you talk about that?
It's very close to, I would say, it's kind of like a borderline personality disorder. And I have never ever considered borderline personality disorder to be a dissociative identity disorder, because you don't often disassociate into having two or more persistent identities in borderline personality disorder, right? I mean, it's usually black and white, right? Borderline.
It is
like
black
and
white.
You go from being rageful to like being like the nicest person in the world, in a sense, right? Black and white.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's also like lately it has been associated with the dissociative personality disorders. So you essentially dissociate from your previous identity and you adopt a totally new identity on yourself. And then you completely forget, you dissociate even with the identity that you had before. And I have seen it on a regular basis when I was working with borderline personality disorder. People will just dissociate with their previous selves and adopt a new identity and lead that identity.
Is it still considered borderline at that point? Or would you actually
it is
consider
borderline.
It to be dissociative? Because you have to have two persistent identities that are that are identities, right? And they don't even relate to one another. There's these gaps into not understanding each identity. So that's blowing my mind, because I did not understand that. I did not know that that is a has been compared in that sense.
Oh yes, with identity, with the dissociative identity disorder. I don't know why we decided to call it the dissociative identity disorder, because it used to be called the multiple personalities disorder, right? But then it fell into the categories of dissociative identity disorders. And this is what we have. Borderlines are also exhibit the dissociative symptoms. And if in dissociative personality disorder with multiple personalities, there's one that governs them all, right? Or different alters. In borderline personality disorder, they are aware of what is happening. It's not like one identity is taking over another. They are aware of what is happening. It's just they will dissociate with the previous one. They will not be speaking with a different tone of with a different voice that it would be in the dissociative personality disorder, but it would be a new identity that I know that some people. And not only they try to adopt the identity of mine, for example, copy me. Some people that I knew that they were copying of different authority figures that they were
like
fascinated
single white
with.
Female? What? Like the movie Single White Female.
I've never seen it. So what is it all about?
I believe is when she starts to take on the, she basically starts to mimic everything about her roommate. She becomes obsessed with.
Oh, that's interesting. I need to see that.
Single white female. I think it's called Single White Female, and she becomes obsessed with a friend or the, I don't recall exactly. It's been a long time since I saw it, but it reminds me of that borderline. I think there was another one. Angelina Jolie was in it. It was like something about girls or something, but it was
disrupted or something, right? Mm-hmm. Girls
disrupted or something. Yep.
Yeah, that is about borderline. Absolutely. It is. And if you're interested, you can watch these two movies. I have to see this one. What is it called? The white female?
Single white female.
White. It was probably made long time ago, right? Nowadays, it would be so politically incorrect.
It was very interesting. And also, was it Sybil that played in it? Didn't she suffer from, I think, schizophrenia? It was a movie that, or multiple personalities. I think I should have looked this up before I'm like spouting it out here, but it's just coming to mind now.
Oh, yes, because knowing the symptoms of different disorders, you are able to even to track back, go back to the films, movies, people that you knew before and say, listen, that we'll talk to yourself, that it sounds familiar. This is something that I have observed that I now understand. So yes, adopting the identity of other people is so easy for borderline. It was spending so much time on borderline.
Narcissism too, antisocial personality. That's how they learn to mimic emotions, because they oftentimes don't have any. So they learn to mimic the emotions they see in others. So people, that's how they learn to do the things that they do. That Sybil is about dissociative identity disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, narcissistic, like you rightfully mentioned, also is a personality disorder. And the prevalence is about 6.2% of the adults in the United States. However, Dr. Ramani, she just recently released her new book, It's Not About You, I think. She says one of the six people has a narcissistic personality disorder. I think that she said the narcissist. Narcissism. But it should be a prevalent traits and symptoms of the narcissism. And of course, like you said, the narcissist or borderline, a lot of the times they will not go to the doctor to seek any help, because they would think that we don't have any problems.
That's why they all center on the cluster B of personality disorders. They're all centered in that emotional, eccentric types of personality disorder.
Oh yes.
There's the three clusters, right? There's the A, B, C. And they center in that B part of it.
The P bar of it, right? So what are their symptoms? Grandiosity, the exaggerated
Yeah,
self-importance,
like erratic. Exactly.
the fantasies of unlimited success, the need of excessive admiration, sense of entitlement, exploitative behavior in relationships. We should know about that. Lack of empathy and envy of others. So, but the narcissistic personality disorder that we can call people narcissists, and a lot of the time we use it ubiquitously throughout the day, or he's a narcissist. Sometimes, or quite often lately, we started using the term narcissist ubiquitously. And why? Because we disagree with that person, right? Or that person disagrees with our statement, right? Or the person does something that we don't like them to do, or vice versa. We
I think
use
a
this.
better way to say that, it appears to me that they are exhibiting symptoms of narcissism, right? They're just to call somebody narcissistic, you could also say, hey, they're narcissistic, from my opinion, right? But just to say somebody is a nar suffers from that disorder, there's a longer list of criteria than someone just cheating or not being themselves or just gaslighting and all those things. It's a lot deeper than some of the things that we may witness in somebody. Same thing with
Absolutely.
OCD, which is also a personality disorder. It's on the cluster C with like avoidance, dependence, and OCD. I think that's another one that we use so lightly, right? We just throw it out there. I'm OCD. I'm obsessive compulsive. But a lot of people who are truly diagnosed with this, it takes over their well-being, their life. They cannot function properly in everyday life. Just like
That's
maybe if
right.
somebody with APD or NPD, narcissistic, they oftentimes can't hold down a job. They can't maintain good relationships, or longevity of things. So if it gets in the way of your everyday living, then chances are it's diagnosable.
Right. And that is the main criteria for the diagnosis, of course, for the disorder. We can have narcissistic tendencies or OCD tendencies, right? But nevertheless, we will not have a disorder. But for example, even when a person is self-confident, right? When the person maintains his or her boundaries and not allowing people to cross them, those people
That's
can also be
healthy.
considered, but unhealthy people consider that narcissism, and then will blame you for that.
Well,
We
that
have.
again, that a person who is calling another person narcissist and they have no clinical experience to do so, they themselves are likely narcissists or exhibiting narcissistic tendencies. If you can agree, I just that's just where I stand on it.
That's
If
it.
so, if you know, if you're calling somebody narcissistic because they're maintaining a boundary, that's some distortion going on there.
Distortion and control. A lot of control. People like to control other people and blame them for something that they have. And we have discussed that there is transference thing, right? That when we transfer whatever we have of negative, essentially our shadow selves, so we just transfer it on other people.
Right, we project what we got going on inside on the outside.
Yeah,
We're
projection,
projecting our
transference,
own
we do
shadows
that.
onto people.
Oh yeah. So while you can observe the narcissistic tendencies in another person, you have to look into yourself and see that, all right, like, is this real? Because it is so ubiquitous. And I cannot tell you, I believe that here the culture in Southern California is very narcissistic culture. And I can safely state that because somehow the society predisposes people to be narcissistic here. And
Like grandiose.
well, not necessarily grandiosity. Grandiosity and also
That's a big claim there.
Oh yes, the some sort of fantasies, that need for excessive admiration. Why do you think that the Hollywood has become so successful here? We see, essentially here in Southern California, all those nails. My God, they can be so long. And every time that I see those artificial nails, I have immediately the thought in my mind that their intellect, is or emotional intelligence is closely proportionate to the size of their nails, right? It is so interesting because not only that, we have all sorts of body augmentations.
Maybe you can say body dysmorphias. So are you kind of saying like the overview of grandiosity and narcissistic perception of a society is creating more obsessive compulsiveness, body dysmorphias, gender disorders? Are you saying that?
Yes. And for example, here, if we look at that, Southern California, Hollywood, what happens is that if the person was more or less stable and went to have the plastic surgery, for example, right, then they may not, and we see it so many times, they may not stop just on one surgery. They will just continue to go and go and go. And
the person
it becomes addiction. And then we talk about OCD, and it's easy to develop all of those disorders. Not that sometimes that we're not born with them. It's easy to develop.
So maybe tendencies instead of disorders. People have a lot of tendencies.
A lot of tendencies. That's right. Not necessarily that would be considered a disorder. We have to understand that. Yeah, so obsessive compulsive, when they have the perfectionism, excessive devotion to work of productivity, they may not be, while that would be the determining factors of the personality disorder, sometimes the perfectionism is not sometimes, but most of the time, perfectionism by itself is not a sign of the disorder, like preoccupation with orderliness, right? Like you want to be clean all the time. If it does not get in the way of your living, right, then you have tendencies. So, but you can have also an inflexibility in morals and values, right? Reluctance to delegate talks, excessive attention to detail sometimes, and or difficulty discarding worthless objects, right? Sometimes it can
hoarding,
that's the word, hoarding, right? So the prevalence in the United States, 7.9% in adults in the United States.
And again, a lot of the times these percentages are reported on behalf of people who are actually probably seeking therapy.
Yes.
Because you'll see a lower percentage that are, you might say, like, God, it seems like there's could be more narcissistic people out there with a diagnosable traits, but they're not diagnosed because they don't go to therapy. Same thing with like maybe schizophrenia. You might see like the 7.9% of people may be diagnosed with it, or that's what we say of the population. But that's generally because they have to be integrated into a system because perhaps their diagnosis got in the way of their everyday living, or they couldn't take care of themselves. So you may see higher percentages of diagnosis in certain disorders than others who are less likely to report.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting numbers for you. Look at the antisocial personality disorder. The prevalence of the antisocial personality disorder is estimated about 0.6% of adults in the United States, although I think it's much, much higher. So what are the symptoms? It's disregard or violation of other people's rights, right? The persistent lying and
deceit. Majority of them are probably diagnosed in prison or in jails.
Absolutely. Yeah. The impulsivity, irritability and aggressiveness, lack of remorse for harmful actions, irresponsible behavior, a pattern of criminal activity. And you're absolutely right. However, the antisocial personality traits are the part of different disorders. And we have to be cognizant of that as well. So it is going to be not necessarily it will be antisocial personality disorder, will be the traits that will be manifesting in other disorders. Yeah. Like, for example, also in there's avoidant personality disorder, hypersensitivity to criticism or rejection, feelings of inadequacy, social inhibition, avoidance of social situations and relationships.
Substance abuse, there's sleep disorders. I mean, there's stress-related traumatic disorders. There's a lot of them that we're not going to be able to cover today.
Yeah, paranoid personality disorder, of course, the suspicion and distrust of others, that can also be a part of different disorders. We won't be able to cover them all, of course. We should probably say a few words about the mood disorders, like we mentioned, the major depressive disorder, which completely incapacitates people, and it is a plague. It is a plague because people are a lot of the times they can't even function. However, I remember Dr. Jordan Peterson, he was also talking about his own diagnosis. Although he got better with the diet, he had a major depressive disorder. And that was no joke. Absolutely. For him, it's he was talking about it, and it is very difficult to live with that.
Wow, it's just as equal as anxiety. I think anxiety is just as important as depression. I mean, you have panics, you have phobias. Think about the people who don't leave their homes, who are afraid to be in social situations. They can't
Oh,
make
yeah.
decisions. Some people can't even make a phone call. You're not even in the presence of another person. So, I mean, anxiety, I think it's really up there on that list too. A lot of people, I think that I would work with would have symptoms of anxiety. Anxiety, not, which. Anytime you're experiencing depression or anxiety, you're unable to live in the present moment. You're either dwelling on or ruminating on something that's happened, or you're worried about something that hasn't happened.
Absolutely.
So
Yeah.
can be
But
chronic.
could be chronic, but sometimes I don't want to make any phone calls and I just cannot bring myself to speak to people. I get the burnout and quite easily sometimes. I don't want to be speaking to people. I don't want to reaching out. I don't want to be picking up the
Well, I
phone when
think
people
a
call.
burnout is one thing, but when you're actually afraid to do that, that can hinder your ability to have gainful relationships, social relationship. It can maybe take you from being severely anxious to experiencing major depression.
Oh yeah. So well, if we are so easily diagnose ourselves with different things, we have to understand that sometimes it's just a part of life. Sometimes, unless it gets in the way, unless you suffer from that tremendously, unless you're not able to live your life happily, right? But depression, anxiety can be a part of life, and that is absolutely normal. You know how many times people come to me and they said, "Oh, I have anxiety. Please help me with that." And when I try to look at their life and tell them that the anxiety that you're experiencing is actually playing a great role in your life. Like, no, I don't like it. It just doesn't feel good. I'm anxious all the time. Please help me with that. And sometimes I refuse to even deal with their anxieties because the anxieties can be just as a fuel for them to be able to overcome some sort of problems in their lives, and absolutely necessary fuel instead of just being medicated, right? And become complacent, like life is absolutely fine, and let's just get on the Prozac, on a different kind of mood stabilizer, and life is going to be good, right? They don't understand that when we have an anxiety, there is something wrong with us, that our psyche is trying to show us that there is a problem somewhere in your life that you need to deal with, whether that's at work, some discontent there, right? Whether
Yeah.
that's something with your health, interpersonal relationships, with anything.
I think it doesn't always mean something's wrong with you. You have a your
Absolutely.
perception is distorted. It's a fear, an anxiety. Often, unless it's a relevant, rational anxiety that you're having, chances are you're just it's just a it's an illusion that appears real. It's something that you're having a delusion of something that appears real. If you're thinking that your partner is like your spouse is doing something behind your back, but I think you have to get to the root of why do I keep thinking these things? What is it about me? I mean, I understand what you're saying. I just don't necessarily mean that something wrong with us. I think sometimes we have these, it's just an escape from reality for a moment. We're believing in something that's not real.
Yes, absolutely. When people have a suspicion that their spouse is doing something wrong, like you mentioned, sometimes we have to look into ourselves and say that, am I just being paranoid? Right? We're not talking about paranoidal
And
disorder, right?
you might be paranoid and find
You
yourself
might be
with a
paranoid.
person. Find your, you should be able to talk to your partner about these things. And if your partner cannot soothe you and they cannot provide you with something that comforts you to say, I understand you're having these feelings, these are not things that, find someone who's going to reassure you. But if you find yourself in a situation where you're always having these things and you're not in a situation that's soothing to you, then that's, your intuition is telling you something about that situation. There's something about it that is not right or that's off.
Right. And unfortunately, also, there are also situations when people become paranoid and in a sense that that would be a part of different disorders or something, the right, situations from their style. Past, attachment style, that's your favorite one, from the previous experiences, and they would be paranoid, of course, they would be taking their feelings and emotions from previous relationships and applying them to the future. And that is very difficult to be vigilant all the time.
Yes.
And that is a problem on its own. However, like, for example, myself,
self-sabotage.
I know myself. I'm not saying that I am a completely healthy person. Life is good. I am a healthy person. And some things that that happened with me, I don't consider pathologies, like even being hypervigilant. Sometimes it is does get in the way and I need to relax. I need to understand that nothing's going to happen. But I also understand that that comes from my past, from the childhood, from escaping, I can't really say like escaping the war because it's such a favorite topic of other people, but having that experience, undergoing and seeing the war and the tanks and the shootings and the murder, that of course that puts you in a situation being hyper vigilant.
Absolutely, and I think that if you're seeking relationships, whether they be friendships, intimate relationships, if you're seeking validation from another person to heal what you are having paranoia about, I believe that you need to spend a little bit more time with yourself to try to understand the anxieties that you are having and how can I bring myself back to the moment when I'm having this paranoia when there's nothing around me that's telling me that this paranoia is real.
That is very interestingly that you mentioned that can happen in borderline personality disorder, and not just only the symptoms. That can be a part of the whole spectrum that makes the borderline personality disorder, because that's when we are, hold on, it just slipped my mind. It is so complex. What did you just said about it? Let me just rewind it a little bit.
If you keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting,
yes.
You know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that exactly. So that could also be the in borderline personality disorder, the expectations that you have of your partner. That could be the paranoia that you're experiencing, the fear that the person is going to leave you. That is, for example, your problem that you have to be dealing with. You have to recognize the patterns. If you have been worrying that every single person that you're with has been intending to leave you, and you get so crazily worried and anxious about it, ask yourself, what is going on? Because there it can get to the level that even if you just your partner just steps out of the room, already can trigger the symptoms of anxiety, abandonment issues. So a lot of the times it can be your partner's problem, of course, that could be narcissistic, could be gaslighting, and you can feel that something is wrong in this relationship, then seek the outside help, validation. Talk to your friends, talk to mental health professionals, right? If you're able
talk to objective people who will
objective
have your best
people.
Interest. People who love you will have your best interest, and oftentimes we don't want to hear that. If you spend more time in your head than you do out of your mind, if you spend more time not in the moment and all over the place wondering what could happen, what if, all that, chances are you're not giving any attention to the relationship that you're currently in. And you are probably a big factor into why the relationship is dissolving, because you're spending so much time between your ears that you're not even in reality. But
that's
if you
right.
do have a severe diagnosis, or you do have a diagnosis that is of, I guess, severe, then yes, seek help or just reach out, because a lot of things can be treated. But you have to be willing.
That is the beginning of the healing process. You have to be willing. That is the beginning of
that. Yeah, because the only way to know the normal is to understand the abnormal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we've been discussing abnormal psychology that plays a vital role in understanding, diagnosing, and treating psychological disorders. So by exploring the complexities of human mind, this will provide insights into the causes, manifestations, treatments of atypical behaviors, thoughts, and emotions. So while we know so much about the abnormal psychology, it is essential to also know ourselves. And looks like, Dr. Sherry, what are we talking about next time?
Well, we have a couple topics that we've discussed.
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to be talking about the shadows of the mind, dark psychology. We are going to go into dark psychology, people. We spoke about the abnormal psychology today. And next time, next Friday, please join us. Don't miss that. We will talk about dark psychology. You don't want to miss that, because we all need to know the symptoms. We need to know how to deal with people, the manipulators. We already discussed that as well, but we'll go deeper into that. So please join us next Friday as we discuss
the abyss.
When we go into the abyss, exactly. Well, you have been with us on United Public Radio Network live from New York, live from
live from New Orleans. It's United Public Radio.
Yeah, live from New Orleans, United Public Radio. So thank you, Dr. Sherry, for this engaging conversation, and we will see you next week, ladies and gentlemen. Up until then, have a fantastic time. See you later. Bye.